that off.
The chair calls the Education Finance Committee meeting to order for Tuesday, March 11, 2025. Members, before we get into the rest of the agenda, Representative Green, you have some guests.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate that, and thank you for spending some time with our special guests. So if you guys look over, we have a whole group of students here, a group from Edina High School, and then also from Bloomington Kennedy High School, so from District 50A. So they've been here all day. And they also witnessed our floor session today, and the response was, wow, that was really just fast. Said, right. Doesn't no. No. So thank you for the shout out, and I'm so glad that they were here.
So thank you. Welcome to the committee. A great bunch, and it was exciting to meet all of you. So thank you very much. Hope you'll find this committee as titillating as the House floor session. And with that, Mr. Schaum, you'll have the DE for us today, right? So with that, we do have a quorum present. Correct. And Representative Bakeberg, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
I have, and I would move to approve the minutes.
Representative Bakeberg moves the approval of the minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Minutes are approved. Members, today we are going to have a series of presentations and discussions. So sit back and take it all in. There's a lot. We're going to start with the February forecast update. As you know, the November forecast has now been updated to the February one. And then we'll do a compensatory revenue review. And after that, the formula funding overview. So you should have a series of documents in your packets. And this will be provided by the nonpartisan staff. I think what we'll do, I'm sure we'll be fine on time. So if you have questions, we can just pause and take those, if that's okay, Mr. Strom, Ms. Perrin. So we'll just take them as they come up so we can, that'll be fine. I think it'll just be easiest. The topics will be very important as we get into our next budget discussions. You already know we have the compensatory decisions and questions that are out there, as well as how the formula works, and then what the impact will be on the revenue forecast. So, members, do you, Mr. Strom, Ms. Perry, Ms. Solvig, do you want to stay here to do this since you're the show, or do you want the test fire stand? What's easiest?
I might prefer to stay here.
Okay, we'll keep you in your seat. Okay. Okay, so with that, members, I will now recognize the nonpartisan staff to begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Solveig Beckel, House Fiscal. We'll be starting with the spreadsheet that is labeled in the top left-hand corner, K-12 Education Finance, February 2025 Forecast, Aid Appropriation Summary. So I'll give you a moment to find that in your packets. While you're doing that, I just want to remind you of the overall forecast. You should have been briefed on the forecast last week by Minnesota Management and Budget. But just to review, for fiscal years 26 and 27, the anticipated budgetary balance is $455.777 million remaining. So that's a positive balance. Without inflation in that calculation, that balance would be $1.601 billion. Again, that's a positive remaining balance.
And Ms. Beckel, one second. Just for those in the audience, these documents are available outside. The students, if any of you want to follow along, you're welcome to grab one. So please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the biennium of fiscal years 28 and 29, the anticipated remaining balance, and again, this is for the whole state, the general fund, is negative $5.995 billion, and that is without inflation, with inflation factored in. Without inflation factored in, the balance is negative $2.379 billion remaining. So that's just the larger overall general fund picture. And then let's shift to the spreadsheet that I mentioned earlier. Looking at this spreadsheet, it should be familiar to the November forecast spreadsheet that we looked at earlier in the year. This is the spreadsheet that you will use as your base budget for creating your bill. To go over how to read this again, From left to right, we have the line number. That's just to help you follow along. Then the program column, that will show you the program name or the division name or the part of the bill. Then the next three columns show the November 2024 forecast numbers. Those are there as a reference. Then the next three columns show the fiscal February 2025 forecast for fiscal years 24 through 25. And then the next column is the change for fiscal years 24 and 25 from the November forecast. It follows pretty much the same way. The next three are fiscal years 26 through 27, and then the change from the February forecast to the November forecast for fiscal years 26, 27. Then fiscal years 28 and 29 for the February forecast, and then finally the change from the February forecast to the November forecast for fiscal years 28 and 29. I won't go through this entire spreadsheet because it is 8 pages, but what I would like to highlight for all of you are those change columns, the ones that are highlighted. Those will typically show zeros for programs that are not forecast, as in based upon something else other than just a standard direct appropriation, so based, for example, off of an entitlement, such as an adjusted pupil unit, or which is basically a proxy we use for enrollment of students. So for those numbers that are not based off of anything like enrollment, those typically do not change. But in those columns, if you do see a number there, it means that it has changed somehow, and that is typically attributable to changes in entitlement. So I'll draw your attention to line 8. That's the general education base. You can see that it increased by just about $3.4 million in fiscal years 24 and 25, but then we can see some pretty significant increases in fiscal years 26 and 27, where it increased by almost $130 million over that biennium. And then in the fiscal years 28 and 29, from November to February, the estimate increased by about $245 million. This is largely attributable to the change in projected inflation, to the change in CPIU. The general education formula, which you're seeing the basic dollar amount, there's 14 components roughly in the general education program, and the base amount is what you're looking at on line 8, is now tied to inflation. So there is a floor of 2% that the formula allowance will increase each year, and a maximum of 3% that the formula allowance will increase each year. So basically, if inflation is below 2%, it will at least be 2%. If inflation is above 3%, it will be maximum 3%. But if you take a look at line 4, that shows the formula allowance inflationary increase percent. So as determined by the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Education, the inflation for fiscal year 26 is 2.7%, for 27, 3%. I believe it was more than 3%, but it's again capped at 3. Fiscal year 28, 3%, again capped at 3%. And then for fiscal year 29, we actually saw inflation below 2%, but again, it has that minimum of 2%. So that those are the main reasons for the increase in that just basic general education program funding. If you go down to lines 20 and 21, you can see that there were changes in the non-public pupil education aid and non-public pupil transportation aid funding. The funds went down a little bit in fiscal years 24 and 25. We're just getting some more actual numbers, some more actual data there. And then you can see that there were some adjustments to the tail numbers, to the current numbers and the tail numbers as well. And again, those are just based on entitlements. Moving down to line 29, you can see that there were changes to the achievement and integration aid. There are some changes to the administrative carve-out as well, because that is tied to the formula for achievement and integration aid. On page 2, on line 36, there were some changes to the charter school building lease aid. You can see that it went down about $21,000 in fiscal years 24 and 25, and then went down a bit more significantly in 26 and 27 and fiscal years 28 and 29. Line 53 is the interdistrict desegregation transportation grants. That funding looks to have gone down. The fiscal year 24 data was used to calculate fiscal year 25 information, and that was reduced based on actual data, and so the funding just went down based on those actual numbers. Line 68 shows the paraprofessional paid orientation aid. This shows a somewhat significant, based on the proportion of funding, reduction in fiscal years 24 and 25. Basically, it's a new program that was put into place in 2023, and what the agency saw was that of the 500 eligible local educational agencies, only about 208 of those availed themselves of this reimbursement option. So it's unclear what take-up rates will be like in the future, but this could change over time, of course. On page 3, line 94, lines 94 and 98, some minor changes to the American Indian Education Aid and the Tribal Contract Schools Aid, again, just driven by enrollment changes. Line 103 shows the Alternative Teacher Compensation Aid, or what is commonly known as QCOMP. That also has some changes, not in fiscal years 24 and 25, but some expected changes in fiscal years 26 and 27 and 28 and 29. Again, highlighting, it's very common for us to see these changes in those forecast programs because students and student demographics just change over time. Line 115 shows the student support personnel aid. You see a reduction in fiscal years 24 and 25. This is largely due to some unspent aid at cooperative districts, but then you see an overall increase in the fiscal years 26 and 27 and 28 and 29. On line 125, we start the special education section. You may have heard during the Minnesota Management and Budget briefing that special education drove quite a bit of the increase in costs to the state. Special education is one of those programs where costs are growing fairly rapidly. Despite the fact that the court-placed special education revenue and the separate sites and programs aid revenue, those are both going down, as well as the travel for home-based services programs. Those all had, you know, somewhat minor reductions. All in all, there were still fairly significant increases in special education aid because of the increased need, the increased number of students eligible for special education services. And special education services are a reimbursement basis. So basically it's just the students are needing these services, and so the state is reimbursing at a certain percent. Right now, 44%, and then moving up to 50% in 2027. Line 135 shows debt service equalization aid. No changes in fiscal years 24 and 25, but some increases in the 26, 27, and 28, 29 biennia. Line 138, long-term facilities maintenance equalized aid. Some small reductions in the current, I guess, biennium. We're almost done with fiscal year 25. And then some increases in the next biennia. Then on lines, 142 and 143, we see the school breakfast and school lunch programs. There are still some increases in the school breakfast program forecast, but now we are seeing some reductions in the school lunch cost expectations. And again, these are based on enrollment, typically. Line 153 is the school library aid. That has some minor fluctuations, as does basic system support for libraries on line 147. And then at the end of all this, we get down to the early childhood section, which sort of starts into the community education area. There have been some changes to the early childhood area with the new Department of Children, Youth, and Families. So if you have any questions on, for example, why are there zeros in fiscal years 24 and 25 on this spreadsheet in this area, please come talk to me. Those costs are being shown in the Children and Families committee area. So it gets a little confusing there. But as you can see, for the forecast programs there, developmental screening aid, early childhood family education aid, and home visiting aid, there are some changes there as well. On lines 174 and 176, you can see adults with disabilities program aid and community education aid. Those also had some pretty significant changes. Community education aid had some pretty significant changes. Adults with disabilities program aid, some changes that are pretty typical to see. We get down to the state agencies area, where typically you don't really see any variation just because those programs are not forecast programs. Those are just appropriations to the agencies. So I'm happy to answer any questions on this spreadsheet, but otherwise I can move ahead to the equally exciting property tax levy spreadsheet.
Members, questions? Okay, Ms. Beckel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, Solvay Beckel, House Fiscal. This time, the spreadsheet is titled in the upper left-hand corner, Education Finance, 2025 February Forecast, Property Tax Levy Tracking. So this looks almost exactly like the November forecast levy tracking. The numbers are all updated to match the Minnesota Department of Education's most recent estimates for all of these programs. There's the general fund levies starting on page one, the community service fund levies starting on page three, also on page three, the debt service fund levies. Then starting on page four, the OPEB or pension debt service levies. And then finally on page five, there are some subtotals and totals, but then there's also the credits to the school property tax levies, which you can see on lines 124 through 127. And then on line 129, you can see the total certified levies for school districts, and this is across the state. So for the year that we are currently in, let's say fiscal year 25, this was paid in 24, there were about $3.867 billion in property tax levies for school districts across the state. So again, please feel free to ask any questions about this as well.
And this may be for Mr. Strom as well, Ms. Beck. Can you just I'm gonna have us take two steps back, Mr. Strom. Can you just walk us through if a school district wants to use a levy, They want to get that portion of the aid. What are their options? How do they go about it? And can you talk about some of the matches that happen in that? And then how does that translate to the spreadsheet you just gave us?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Beckel may want to jump in on this as well. Essentially, each of those programs listed on Ms. Beckel's spreadsheet are a separate program where the legislature has authorized spending by school boards through the local property tax levy. Usually these amounts are set either at an amount necessary to pay for some costs or on a formula basis, on a per pupil basis, like the Safe Schools levy. The school board, when they go through their process in the fall, they establish their levies, and they're free to levy an amount less in each of these categories, but they are constrained by the levy limits. And there are just a few exceptions to the levy limits. Three of those require voter approval. And these are shown on Ms. Beckel's spreadsheet. The operating referendum is shown on line 8, and you can see this is a major portion of the overall school levies. If a school district wants to have their voters approve additional property tax levies, they can go at November election and ask for an increase in the operating referendum levy. This amount is capped, so a number of metro area school districts are at the cap. But for other districts, they're free to go to the voters, and if the voters approve a levy, that authority is granted and added to the amount of the school district's entire levy. You asked about equalization, which is the word we use to discuss a levy that's a mix of aid and levy, and the referendum, operating referendum's an example of this. For lower property wealth school districts, where we measure the tax base, which is the referendum market value tax base divided by the pupil counts, for those with lower value, in an attempt to equalize tax rates among school districts, the state provides equalization aid. And that equalization aid then helps the lower tax base districts reduce their levies, essentially reduce the rate for those, keeping the revenue the same. So the state aid for the equalized programs is essentially filling in around the levy for those districts that are low property value. In your communities, you may have both high value districts and low property value districts. Often the difference on referendum market value is whether or not the district has significant commercial industrial property or not. But the equalization aid is down to less than a fifth of the total revenue for the operating referendum. But essentially, that's how that works. The other two levies, well, as long as we're on page one here, there's another levy where school districts have some authority on lines 25 and 26 for long-term facilities maintenance. Well, this is a formula-driven levy. If a school board needs to do a health and safety project over $100,000, qualifying projects fall into this category as well. So the board may authorize additional health and safety work at board approval, which is a type of cost reimbursement on the levy, and that may increase the local levy as well. But the other two elections are for the what's often called the technology levy or the capital projects levy, which is on line 29 of Ms. Beckel's spreadsheet, and you can see that's growing over time. The metro districts, particularly that are capped on the operating referendum, have been turning to the capital projects or technology levy for additional funding. And then finally, if you turn to line 77 on page 3, beginning on page 3 of Ms. Beckel's worksheet, on the debt service area, most of the school districts in the state, in fact, nearly all go to the voters to approve building bonds, and those building bonds are repaid with a local levy each year. So that's another type of election that school districts may hold so that the school board may increase its property tax levy. The amount that the district approves or has for debt levy essentially depends on the question that the board asks the voters. In some districts, they've had very large bond issues in the past. Some districts have been unable to pass bond issues. So it's a real mix across the state. And Ms. Beckel pointed you to the credits on the last page of the worksheet, and you'll notice the credit that's growing the most over time is on line 124, the school building bond ag credit. That credit was initiated about 10 years ago, and that helps school districts that have considerable amounts of ag property in the district by providing a credit that's 70% of the amount of the building that the farmers would pay on their lands. That amount is paid for through the state credit instead. But those are the three areas, otherwise the school board is levy limited by those that you set in statute. The three areas where there's an exception is where they can go to the voters on the referendum, the capital projects referendum, or for building projects where the voters approve a higher level of spending for one of those three categories.
And Mr. Strom, we hear oftentimes in committee, we've had testimony, not yet this year, but in years past, so for members that aren't familiar with this, can you talk a little bit about the levies where school boards can authorize those, reauthorize those without a voter approval?
Mr. Chair, members, if you go back to line 8 on the operating referendum, a few years ago, the authority for operating referendum carries on for up to 10 years. The amount is put on the question that's asked at the referendum. And a few years back, the legislature authorized those to be extended by up to 10 years by the school board upon board action. So the operating referendum can be extended by board action. Neither the technology levy nor debt bond levies for buildings, neither of those can be extended by voter action, those or by board action. Those have to be re-upped by the voters.
And I have a couple questions coming up as well. So, and when, and I'm not trying to get into the political side of this question, but when we go to a levy and we do that, we are impacting a tax. Now, some districts, that tax may go up, some may go down, depending on how the match is. Can you just elaborate a little bit on that? Because I know districts are always trying to educate their voters on what those impacts could be.
Mr. Chair, members, many of the levies that you see on this spreadsheet are based on a limit of an amount per pupil that's set in statute or an amount per pupil that's approved by the voters. As the pupil count declines, things like Safe Schools revenue and the operating referendum, those levy amounts are going to go down. So many districts are seeing in some of their school districts, particularly those that did not approve building bonds recently, are seeing a reduction in their overall levies, while those with big building projects are often seeing an increase. If you go to, Ms. Beckel's got such good stuff on her spreadsheet, if you go to the totals line, on line 120 to 122, you'll see the percent changes across. And one thing you'll notice is that in the years, usually the school districts tend to go out to the voters in the odd-numbered years, not the even-numbered years, for their referendum approval. And you'll see that pattern on the spreadsheet some, but you can see for the current year we're in, pay 25, school levies are only expected to grow by about 0.4% for this year. But next year, assuming there's going to be a whole variety of referendum and debt levies this fall, the department's best guess is that there'll be $180 million of additional levy above this year's level next year. But for individual districts, the biggest thing that causes a big drop in their levy from year to year is some building bonds being paid off, and the biggest thing that causes an increase is approval of additional building bonds. So that's why for legislators that have more than one school district in your legislative district, you'll often see some districts' levies going up and others going down, basically due to no changes here at the legislature, but instead due to bond issues approved or not. Or even when a school district approves a bond issue, often they don't have unlike a mortgage where you're often going to have an even payment per year. School districts, for a variety of reasons, may have an uneven debt payment to correspond to other things going on in the school district. But those are the biggest factors. The operating referendum at $800+ million and the debt levy total of over $1 billion, those make up more than half of all the school levies, and those are the two that vary the most from district to district.
three more from me. Explain the debt service levy, if you would.
Mr. Chair, when school districts sell bonds, they go to the voters and tell the voters, hey, we want to build some new schools or remodel a school. They put the question of the amount of bonds to be sold on the ballot. And if the voters approve that, then the school district with that approved bond authority goes to the bond house and essentially says, okay, we'd like to sell for a $50 million project, we'd like to sell $50 million of bonds. And then over the next 20 years, the school districts will repay those bonds with an annual property tax levy. And unlike a mortgage where the payer is usually paying per month, for school districts, they have two big payments a year, usually an August payment and a January payment. And the August payment's often interest only, and the January payment is the principal for that year as well as 6 months' worth of interest.
Very well. Last two, I promise they're short. Talk about the why we don't get to just pick our levy target in this committee and why we should hate on the tax committee.
Mr. Chair, I suspect you and Representative Joachim will be beating a path to the Tax Committee this year and in following years. The issue on school levies is unlike the aid target, where there's an official target usually assigned by leadership, it's been the practice in the House for more than 30 years that there's an informal levy target of zero. You all as Education Committee members are instructed by the Tax Committee that they don't expect you to be raising any property taxes that they'll then have to turn around and lower through their actions. So this committee functions under a zero levy target. So even if your district has the best idea in the world and it would raise property taxes, if you approved a bill that raised $1 million of property taxes for a district, you'd have to reduce your other levies by $1 million to hit that informal target. It's an informal target. It's not in the House rules. It's not adopted as a resolution, but it is as real as any of your other targets, and your bill essentially is subject to that, and it's in large part because the Tax Committee spends much of their time thinking about how they're going to reduce property taxes, and they don't want the education committees of the legislature to turn right around and increase property taxes over the baseline level. So your levy target, if you look at Ms. Beckel's spreadsheet, your levy target is going to be that bottom line amount that your levies can't be above the baseline amounts. And as a way of thinking about this, the levies, the Pay 25 levies already been set, which goes with fiscal year 26. So you really have only 1 year of levy in the current budget cycle since Pay 25's been set. So the levies you'll be looking at, if you were to change anything, which you'd need to make another change to keep to the zero target, would be for fiscal years 27, 28, and 29.
So our homework assignment, members, is to increase our aid target while getting the Tax Committee to take as much of our aid target hidden into their levy target so that we can get the best of both worlds. So please help us work on that. And then the last one I have, and then I'm going to go to lead you, Akeen, Green, and Vernon. So this is, I hear it all the time. Why do metro school districts get to maximize their facilities, and we don't, our facility fundings, when it comes to this? What is happening there that we need to continue to look at?
Mr. Chair, members, for building bond projects, the biggest issue is essentially whether the voters will approve the bond issue or not. And in large part, that is determined by the impact that's going to have on individual taxpayers. So in some communities with relatively low tax base, they have been able to convince their citizens to vote for a higher a levy through approving a big bond issue, but their tax rates then reflect that higher level. The majority of districts in the metro area have much higher tax bases than in total than most greater Minnesota districts. So as a result, the rate that's necessary to support a $50 or $100 million school in the metro area is usually going to be lower than that rate in a greater Minnesota community. So it's both a tax base issue and a willingness of the voters to approve the bond issue. Representative Vernick's community, I believe, has approved the largest bond issue in the state. I think they approved one for nearly $500 million a couple of years ago. But in general, it's because of that tax rate differential, and that's where equalization comes into play. And Mr. Withers reminds me as well that there is also on the long-term facilities maintenance program, the school districts that were large school districts prior to the creation of that revenue were in a program called Alternative Facilities, and those school districts are continued to be accepted from the $380 pupil cap of long-term facilities maintenance revenue, LTFM, and they can levy essentially any amounts for deferred maintenance. So that's another big issue. Those, as I mentioned when we talked about LTFM earlier, those are not voter-approved amounts. Those are board-approved, and those 26 large districts, most of those were in the metro area, those districts are able to exceed the per pupil cap on that formula because they were in a different program prior to the creation of LTFM.
Thank you very much. Okay, so we have a couple of questions coming up. Chair Uakim, let's start with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Krusha, and thank you for asking those questions around the levies. It's always hard to try to explain to folks that depending on your property wealth depends on sometimes how well you can educate your students, and to try to get away from that, we do have equalization. I've carried a bill for 3 years now to try to improve it because it's stuck on old models. So the local optional revenue is $724 a student that districts can tax. I think if we raise that part, it should be in this committee. But as you said, Chair Krusian, one of the main reasons why I got on the tax committee was that if you are doing the equalization, that's a direct property tax issue and should be in the tax bill. But to explain, and I'm just going to explain quick because we have some students in the office, so audience. So let's say Edina wanted to go out for a dollar of tax levy per pupil. Because you have wealthier either properties or commercial industrial or a lot of other buildings, or you're denser, your land value is more. So you might only have to ask your resident for 50 cents to get that dollar. But if you go out to another community that might just be all residential and don't have much commercial industrial, they might have to ask for $1.50 to get that dollar from their taxpayers. So it makes it a little harder to pass a referendum. If you have farm property, which has a lot of acreage, that's why we did the farm to school. So they pay the same tax on their one house, an acre, and a garage, but all their acreage that's in farming has a smaller tax value. So that was a way to put into place, the state pays for 80% of the tax on that land if there's a bond levy. And then the farmer only pays 20%. And that was a way to help get those levies passed. We also, like I said, we do make that equalization between that dollar and that $1.50 to try to make it so that they can get, the property poor districts can get that same value out of that dollar. But we have not changed the equalization factor for that for a few years. It's in two different tiers and they have two different values on it, and housing values have increased past that. So we really do need to pass an equalization bill. When we talk about debt service levies, I'm glad you asked that too. That's where it's really important to keep our state credit rating very high. We're AAA. It means that you can borrow for less money, less interest. And let's see, I think that's all I was going to, I just wanted to explain that a little bit easier so folks could understand it. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Green.
Thank you, Chair. I just had a question about the operating levy when you talked about that and that section. So when you were talking about the percent change from the prior year, those percentages are only based, if I'm reading this right, only based on the numbers above. It's not based on whether a levy passed or not. It's not what we went out for, schools went out for. It's only on the result. Is that right?
Mr. Strom.
Chair Krisha, Representative Green, yes, the amounts that are reflected in there through the current year, through pay 25, are based on the actual levies that were certified, and the department is guessing, they use a model to guess how many additional operating referendum amounts will be approved in each of the next 3 years. So the numbers for 26, 27, and 28 reflect a guess at how many will be approved and at what value, which may or may not happen. But these are the not just the amounts asked; these show the actual amounts certified. And I should add that in a year like this year, where you can see for pay 25 a 0.4% increase, that's of course on the statewide total and does not reflect how the tax for an individual taxpayer may vary. Individual values may increase or decrease from year to year, and some taxpayers this past year on their school taxes may have had an increase or decrease solely due to their change in value. So it's also not reflective of what may happen on a value basis. And of course, school taxes are about a third of the total property tax bill. So what cities and counties do also affects each taxpayer's individual property tax bill.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Chair. So do we ever track like levies that pass or not and report out on that? Is that part of a report? I'm new still. So just curious if that data is available.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, yes, it is. The department does a very nice job of tracking those elections, and each November they put out a spreadsheet that shows the history since the early 80s of how many referendums have passed and how many have failed and what the dollar values are of those. We could share that spreadsheet with you. I'd be glad to send that to the Chair and Representative Green for distribution to the committee.
Thank you.
Representative Erning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a few questions. Of course, I think we all know I get super excited when we talk about LTFM and roofs, right? Mm-hmm. And I appreciate you bringing up the ALT facilities. So that's 26 schools that can levy for unlimited and 300, plus, little over 300 that are capped at 380. When was the last time that 380 was increased?
Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vernon, the long-term facilities program phased in starting in, I believe, fiscal year 2017. And so the first year it was a third of that amount, the second year it was two-thirds, and then the third year it went to the 380. And I should add that charter schools get a smaller amount. Charter schools only get about $130 per pupil unit in their LTFM category.
Representative Vernon.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for the explanation. I have another question that maybe you can help explain since we have students here who may not understand, and I hear this a lot, that there are a lot of schools that have no levy authority across the state. Can you explain what that may mean?
Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vernon, did you say no levy authority?
Yeah, or they can't pass their levies, you know.
Did you mean no levy in place?
Thank you. Yes, thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vernon, for the voter-approved levies, the school district goes to the voters and says, hey, would you like to build a new school? Sometimes the package that the district puts together is not in keeping with what the taxpayer's vision is. Sometimes the location of the project may be being built in the wrong community for what the taxpayers want, or maybe doing the wrong kind of work, or maybe too expansionary in its view can lead to bond issues to fail. On terms of the other levies that are not voter approved, school boards are also sensitive to the tax rates that their taxpayers are facing. And so some school districts may choose not to do certain types of the other levies or certain types of projects, even if they have the authority to do so because of a sensitivity over the bills that their taxpayers are paying. So it can be for a variety of reasons, but on the bond issues, on both bond issues and the operating referendum, there's been a big Metro Greater Minnesota divide over the last 10 years at least in terms of the approval rates, much higher approval in the metro area than Greater Minnesota. And so that explains part of that difference is the willingness of voters to approve those, and whether that's based on the projects or the tax implications is not something I could speculate on, but there has been a divide in recent years.
Representative Vernon, quick follow-up.
Thank you. I guess one of the things I'm trying to illustrate here is the difference, the disparity across, right? So you mentioned it earlier. I have a district that passed the largest bond or referendum, you know, and there are schools that have little or no extra funds coming in. Same with alt facilities. And it's a challenge, right, to fund education. And we have schools that have a lot of funds. And as we heard from Pequot Lakes and others who came in, who have little or no additional funding. There's one unique piece on here that I learned about as a school board member, and I was hoping you could maybe explain, I don't know if everybody is aware, what an OPEB is, and do all schools have access to that?
Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vernig, there's two lines, sets of lines on the spreadsheet for OPEB. OPEB is an acronym that stands for Other Post-Employment Benefits. And these are essentially health benefits paid to retired employees. There's two parts of those. There's the direct part of that, and then state law allows retired individuals to stay in local and state retirement or local and state health systems after they retire. They can buy in. Because that puts older and potentially higher users of health care in those groups, there's something called an implicit rate subsidy as well. So those two parts make up the other post-employment benefits that school districts face. There was a short window in 2008, I believe, where districts were, thanks to your friends on the tax committee, there was a one-year window where school districts without voter approval could sell bonds to repay, essentially forward pay these OPEB amounts. And if you look on Ms. Beckel's spreadsheet on line 115, you'll see that amount is dropping from year to year, such that when you get to pay 29, there'll be just $17 million left of the bonded debt. That's because for those school districts that issued the bonds in that one-year window, those bonds are essentially being paid off now, and they put the bonding amounts in a special fund, and then each year as those OPEB costs occurred, they paid those out. The pay-as-you-go line on Ms. Beckel's spreadsheet is on page 2, and let me just find the right line here. And you'll see that that amount is increasing on line 41, oops, that's the adjustment. Line 30 is the annual, what's often referred to as the pay-as-you-go OPEB levy. And for the school districts that are taking that approach, you can see that amount is essentially increasing over time. But one, I should add one final comment on this. The changes when the OPEB levy went into place essentially required school districts to remove provisions for future employees from the contracts that would pay retiree health benefits. So there's still the implicit rate subsidy going forward, but school districts that participated in OPEB no longer cover employees hired since that time with retiree health insurance payments.
Thank you.
Representative Ingham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I know this is a little bit different than what we've been discussing thus far, but do we have a total value of the dollars that MDE retains for anything, grant management, O&M costs, salaries, implementation of programs, et cetera?
And Representative Ingham, is that related to the levies, or are you branching off to the grant stuff?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm completely branching off here.
If we could, Representative Ingham, can we take that one offline and maybe come back to it? Unless you have it readily available, Representative, or Mr. Strom or Ms. Beckel. Ms. Beckel?
Mr. Chair and members, Solvay Beckel, House Fiscal. Some weeks ago in committee, we discussed the administrative funding, so let me just pull that spreadsheet up.
I think what we're going to do, Representative Ingham, I'm going to pause you for a second, give her time. I'm going to come back to you. Representative Reimer, do you have to the levies, or are you going another topic?
Also with appropriations. So
okay, got it. And then Representative DePell, are you to the levies on this, or are we moving to a different topic?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It has something to do with the levy as it would affect school funding, generally speaking, and has to do with the president's executive order on education.
Okay, so let's go to Representative DePell, and then I'm going to go back Ingen and Reimer. I'll circle back.
So the education executive order expands opportunities for low-income working families, military families, Bureau of Indian Education, schools, and so on. And so within that funding program, a multitude of different funds would be taken and given to different states for different school programs. It would be about $10,000 per student. And I just wonder, first of all, what effect that would have on the budget if $10,000 per student was given for education freedom. This would also go towards public school students, and it expands the 529 tax credit or savings account, so there's non-taxable funds that can be utilized there too, in conjunction with that $10,000. Does House Fiscal, I really appreciate Mr. Strom and Ms. Beckel and their very deep understanding of the finances within our state education system. What impact would that have both on levies and education finance in general, but rather bolstering the levy program that school districts utilize?
Okay, so my apologies, and I want to get to this, so let's take this one, and then I want to make sure I come back, and I apologize, I have a couple things percolating now. So Representative DePell, let's get an answer to yours first.
Mr. Chair, Representative DePell, I think the single biggest place on the levy side this would affect is any levy that's set as a per pupil amount is based on essentially the pupils served by school districts. So if federal money were redirected to the program that the executive order mentions and students were to leave the public school system and use that money elsewhere, anything that's calculated on a per pupil basis would go down some. So one would expect that the formula-driven levies outside of things like debt levy that are on a total amount, that those categories of funding would probably go down some by the number of students switching from one type of education system to another. On the aid side, that would also apply probably to programs like general education, and the issue there again is pupil-driven costs are probably different than those that are cost-driven, where there might not be many implications. There'd be many other potential budget implications depending on how the federal money were actually directed and whether other federal money were taken from one place or another. But the relatively short question on both levies and aids is there should be a reduction on the amounts that you'd see on these spreadsheets, because the primary thing that drives the levy and the aid is the number of students in each school district.
Representative DePell, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up. So we've continuously heard from principals, from superintendents, and other school administration that it looks bleak. Our budget looks difficult to manage over the course of the next session. There's a big deficit looming. And we look at these numbers, and it's a lot of numbers, and a lot of the numbers are very big. And it seems to me that we should consider the financing revenue streams that we would get from the federal government and that have generally been promised from the current administration to both alleviate issues that are occurring at a state level from a budget perspective, but not only a budget perspective, also a school freedom perspective, to give parents as many options as they could enjoy for their children. We've talked a lot about local control for school boards and districts. The most local control is the parents, and the parents should have complete and total control over their children's education. So within that realm, I appreciate that feedback, but I also believe on the financial side, this could bring the relief that Minnesota truly needs on a financial spectrum. We know how big the budget is for education. It's constitutionally mandated. We want to give these kids the best opportunity in education they can possibly get under any circumstance in which especially their parents believe that could occur. So I appreciate it, Mr. Chair, and also research. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Beckel, let's come back to you for Representative Engen's question. Do you need it repeated, or do you have the info now?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Solveig Beckel, House Fiscal. I believe the question was, what are the administrative funds retained by the Minnesota Department of Education, including grant fund set-asides and direct administrative funding. Is that correct?
Representative Ingen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, that's correct. Any amount of appropriations that they maintain, whether with salaries, O&M costs for grants, and everything else. Yeah, thank you.
Ms. Beckel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So I do have that for general fund right here. I can get back to you with the other funding. So for the general fund, what I was able to determine earlier this year was it was roughly $108 million in fiscal years 24 and 25, $116 million in fiscal years 26 and 27, and $116 million for fiscal years 28 and 29. And then, of course, MDE receives funding from the federal government, so there are a number of federal funds coming to them through Title I, Title II, Title III, Title IV. And then there are some special revenue funds that include some external grant funding that MDE has applied for and received as the grantee. And those are the main funds that MDE receives.
Okay. Another follow-up, or are you good, Representing?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we happen to have those numbers on hand? And if you don't, I don't want to press you for them. But if you do, I just wanted to ask. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Beckel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Engen. They are on my computer. I do not have them pulled up, but I can certainly circle back and get those to you.
Very good. Representative Reimer, and then we're going to go to compensatory and formula. And then any other questions, if we have time, we can circle back because everything will be relevant. Representative Reimer, last one before we go to Act Two.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Beckel, Mr. Strom, I apologize that we're kind of ping-ponging back and forth between levies and the aid appropriation spreadsheet. I'm a little bit slow and sometimes had to retake math classes in the summer. So for any students out there that had to retake math classes, just know you could one day be an esteemed state representative, even if you do. My question is kind of going back to, and I think it deals mainly with Ed Minnesota and probably state agencies, but kind of percolating after talking to some districts or some school districts in my district, what is kind of the overall, do we have like a sum total portion of education funding, like dealing with the rollouts and enforcement of some of the mandates that were passed last session? Is there a place in maybe the appropriation spreadsheet where we can get the sum total of enforcement in particular of new mandates?
Mr. Strom, Ms. Pera, Ms. Beckel? How do you want to answer that one?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Reimer. As the spreadsheet, so as I organize the spreadsheet, I typically do organize it by bill article. So this is traditionally how the education finance bill has been structured. I have not broken it out by just the new item funding. I can provide you a change spreadsheet from fiscal year from the 2023 session and the 2024 session if you just want to look at those change items from those years.
Representative Reimer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, that'd be extremely helpful. I'd love to get those numbers.
And Representative Vernig, I do have you on the list, but I'm going to hold you to the end as we get through. So thank you for that. Thank you for the questions. Lots of good conversation. So we're going to go to Act Two, where the plot twist will happen, compensatory revenue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. The goal here as well is to inform you about compensatory revenue, but also have you get your questions answered on the program. There's a four-page summary document on compensatory revenue. And most of it's historical information that you can read on your own, perhaps. There's two tables or two charts in the presentation that might be helpful to you. And if we go to the first of those on page two, Let me say just a word about what compensatory revenue is, and then we'll talk about the two charts primarily, and hopefully generate some questions for you on this. The second biggest part of the general education formula after the basic formula allowance is compensatory revenue. Compensatory revenue is the state's formula that uses a proxy variable, currently the free and reduced lunch count, as a way to generate additional funds for school districts that may have additional academic needs. Compensatory revenue has been in the formula since 1969, but it's grown substantially over time and now is a pretty significant part of all the general education revenue that goes out to school districts. All school districts receive compensatory revenue. It's a site-based formula, and it's what's called a concentration formula. So the greater the number of compensatory students at each site, not only are you getting additional money for each additional compensatory student, but they count for more the higher the concentration is. Ms. Beckel's school finance guide has just an excellent way to work through an example of calculating compensatory revenue in a district, and so that's a good place for you to look if you want to put in some numbers, sort of working through an example for how it would affect a site in your district. Over time, compensatory revenue has changed in part because the compensatory student count has changed. Since 1996, the state has used the free and reduced lunch count as its proxy variable, and you'll see a chart on page 2 that shows in the dark part of the bar the number of free lunch students reported at each school site, and on the shaded portion at the top, the number of reduced price meal eligible students at each site. Those categories, free and reduced price, are set by the federal government as part of the school meals program. They're based on 130% of the federal poverty level for free lunch, and between 130 and 185% of the federal poverty level for reduced price meal eligibility. Those amounts, the actual amounts, change each year as the federal government sets the federal poverty line, and they also vary by family size. The poverty measure that's used essentially increases in as the family size increases. But you can see from this chart that through the aughts, basically from 2003 up to about 2012 or 13, the number of free and reduced lunch students was increasing each year. That count was done with both a direct match, sometimes called direct certification, where the state would line up data on participation in other public assistance programs like SNAP and TANF, and it also included the paper forms that families turned in for eligibility for free and reduced price meals. Those paper forms now are sometimes online and are referred to as application for educational benefits. But essentially from 2003 up until this current year, both paper forms and the direct match were used to determine eligibility. And for the years that we have data, between 70 and 80% of the forms in the early years were turned in were essentially a direct certification, and the rest were through the paper applications. But the percentage varies a lot by districts for reasons that I am not entirely familiar with. When you look at the count, you'll see that the count declined during the teens from about 2015 to 2020. For the fall counts, you can see modest declines in the number of students eligible for free or reduced price meals. And then in 20 and 21, the fall of those 2 years, you see a big drop in the number of eligible students. This was in part because of the enrollment pattern changes because of COVID. It's also in part because of the free meals offered by the federal government in 20 and 21. Then in 2022, you'll see that the amount spiked. The number of free and reduced price meal eligible students went way up in that year, and that's because the administrative decision was made at the Department of Education to include families that were eligible through medical assistance that met the free and reduced lunch income standards in the count as well. So you can see the count jumped from almost just a bit over 30% in 2021 to well over 40% in 2022 because more students were identified through the direct match. Then you can see in 23 that count fell a bit, and then in 24 the count fell further, but there's a couple caveats here. The first of the 24, you'll see that line, that bar is on the chart twice. The first bar there shows the direct certified as well as the paper applications. But note that not all districts, because the paper applications are no longer used in the count starting with last fall's count, not all districts turned in paper application information to the department, nor did they pursue as aggressively as they might have in the past paper applications. But regardless, the count fell, including paper applications, to right about 40%. And then the amount that's actually going to be used for the formula for fiscal 26 and forward as part of the 2023 laws change is the direct certified amount only. And you can see that that count is 2024 DC is what the legend says there. And you can see that that count is back down quite a bit. That's just the direct certification number, and that's the amount that's going to be used in the count for calculating compensatory revenue for 2026 and going forward. The pupil counts, the questions often asked, why were the pupils eligible increasing from 23 to 2015 and decreasing from 2015 on to 2020? And I suspect a portion of that was due to the strong economy at the time that probably had a fair amount to do with family eligibility. The second thing that happens is the mix of students in Minnesota schools can change from year to year. So it may be partially related to the students who are enrolling first in the school districts in Minnesota. But you can see the shape of that curve was up and then down from 2003 to 2021. So, Mr. Chair, that's a quick review of the eligible students in Minnesota. As I mentioned at the beginning of the discussion of counts, some states use a different measure. A state could use a measure like the like a census measure. The original measure in Minnesota was based on a federal program called Aid to Families with Dependent Children. There's a number of ways a proxy variable could be chosen, but since 1996, Minnesota's used the free lunch count.
And Mr. Strom, before I go on to a couple other questions, what can schools use compensatory revenue for? So that's a separate line item. How is that money expended?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, in statute, there's a list of 11 uses. The legislative auditor had a report in 2020 that was very helpful, and there's a link at the front of the printed document there to their report. I'd encourage you all to read the summary of their report. The uses really have to do with almost any purpose related to enhancing academic performance of students. The students who qualify for free and reduced price meals aren't the students that the money needs to be directed to. The money needs to stay at the site, but the students at the site should be essentially identified by those that need additional assistance for academic performance. Those 11 uses are in the statute in 126C15, if members are interested in looking at those. But they're pretty comprehensive. So most districts have a pretty robust set of purposes that they use compensatory revenue for. And one of the Office of Legislative Audit's findings was because compensatory revenue is such a big source of revenue for school districts, it was really hard when they did their review. They determined they couldn't separate out the impact of compensatory only because it was so interwoven with other school funding sources. But again, I'd encourage folks to look at the very comprehensive report on compensatory revenue that came out in 2020 by the Office of the Legislative Auditor.
Thank you. And so members, if you haven't seen it, this is what it looks like. You can get this. I believe the reference library has it as well as other sources, and it is a worthwhile read. We talked briefly this week about the families that may have improvement in their income status, and that, of course, would drop them off. And now as I look at the chart here, I look at your table one. Before we went to adding the MA criteria, it looks like, I mean, at first blush, we could be seeing the impacts of those improvements as people, as families were dropping off and that need was changing. But now, because one of the things, as we had a conversation, members, was how do we track that? I mean, the goal of compensatory aid is to help families, but once things improve, that they come off. That would be in an ideal situation. But and so what we were trying to calculate, because this is going to be a very, just a wide-swinging dollar change, but with the addition of the MA, that really throws things out of whack, doesn't it? It doesn't allow us to have to follow that line anymore, because now we've added another criteria. Any thoughts on that since we discussed that?
Mr. Chair, members, I think that's exactly right, that the data series is really not comparable prior and to 2022 and after that count because of the inclusion of MA matching. And of course, 2022 was probably the heaviest year of MA usage in Minnesota. And it's hard to separate out whether that usage is going back down or whether there are reasons why families would qualify but aren't qualifying. There were renewal issues for medical assistance that were waived during some of the COVID years. So there's a variety of things that could be changing, but it also could be that those numbers are dropping because of better economic conditions as well. It's very hard to know. There's no real data we have on why there was under-identification with the paper forms prior prior to the inclusion of the direct match on medical assistance, and also hard to know why there's such variation from district to district on the number of students that were identified through a direct match versus the percentage identified through the paper applications.
And so, members, to that point, one of the difficulties we face, or legislators face in future, when you go to the OLA report or you go to this, is what do the dollars that come through this committee actually impact? What is, you know, trying to find those correlations, causations, and so forth, because that's ultimately what we have to decide, is how we fight for that and the end result. So, Mr. Strong, if you could answer two more questions for me. One is the concentration factor, and then the site-based. I know I've seen bills in the past to help schools move it from site to site, even elementary schools and larger ones, and that has had much discussion. So,
Mr. Chair, in terms of the site-based issue, prior to 96, the money simply went at the district level and school boards were responsible for determining the portion at each site. Since 96, there have been requirements for a certain legislatively specified percent to stay at each site. And individual school districts may vary the amounts within the target that the legislature sets for that. It's currently back at 80% that's got to stay at the site. And their reasons often are that the measure of poverty doesn't match the academic need at that school site as well as it otherwise could, or that there's some reason why providing services at a different site may make better sense than keeping all of the money or 80% of the money at that particular site. For all the members on the committee that have been on school boards that have more than one school site, they can probably tell you why. For their district budget reasons, why they sometimes feel that they would prefer to allocate money differently at the site to meet that same goal of enhancing academic performance, not for other reasons. So there's a variety of issues related to the site level calculation, and districts, district boards often respond differently. I know in a few years ago when the amount was increased from 50% to 80%, the superintendent of Richfield was here and explained why there was greater need at one of his two buildings, but the measurement of free and reduced lunch eligible at that site was not sufficient to show that. And that was his argument for why the school board should have more authority to move money between sites. And I'm sorry, I missed the first part of your
concentration factor, Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Chair, members, the concentration factor means that the kids at the margin come in at the highest level. You'll probably see this when you turn the page. When those kids are lost, you're losing essentially at the margin, you're losing the highest eligible revenue student from each site. The concentration is deliberate. It's a legislative decision to make. Whether the concentration is too great or not great enough is something this committee should consider. But essentially what happens is if your site has 70 or 80% concentration, you're going to get quite a bit more money, not just proportionately, but per compensatory student than if you had 40 or 50% at that site. And that's a deliberate legislative decision. Many of you with districts that with more than one school district in your legislative district have districts all over the board on that concentration formula. But essentially, it's not the same amount per compensatory pupil. It depends on the concentration at that particular site.
And so with that, Mr. Strom, so I'll add for the committee's benefit. Sometimes we fall into the trap of the large school district versus the small one. You use rural metro. Really, I think that conversation is imprecise because as I tell my kids when we're driving, every time you get in the car, things are different. There is no two trips. It's the same thing with school districts. Every school district has its own unique challenges and so forth. And, you know, those of us that are familiar with the rural school districts that we work in, it should not be lost on us the incredible challenges that a large school district faces within their sites. And so, you know, getting back to that and really, that's why the conversation, I think, flexibility continues to come up. There's no way that a school district that I might be familiar with could mirror or understand the challenges that are faced by a larger school district trying to service those kids moving in and out of neighborhoods, populations, or areas just within their town. So I think that really adds to the dynamic and many of the intricacies that we face. So, all right. That would conclude that. I can take questions on the compensatory. I do have Representative Vernig for the list. Then we're going to go into Act 3 where things don't go well for Hamlet. And we'll go into the general formula and wrap up with questions. So, Representative Vernig, did you want to go to this or did you want to be first on the list for the end?
I'll be first on the list at the end, please.
First on the list for the end. Very nice. Chair Uwakim.
Thank you, Chair Krisha. And compensatory aid has become a hot-button issue just because when we did universal meals, how those forms affected that formula. But always remembering that compensatory aid is different because it's not a per-pupil-to-per-pupil dollar like it is with EL or the daily membership numbers. It's supposed to be a proxy for an assumption of what those students that might have more needs look like. And we have been struggling with that. A few people have for quite a few years. Representative Feist has been working on it for about four. So you will see in the governor's bill he has an approach. Representative Feist has a different approach in her bill, but all of them have been talking, well, Representative Feist has been talking really closely with the school districts. And we look forward to continuing that conversation and trying to figure out how we can level things out this year as a Band-Aid, and then, yes, moving forward, trying to figure out how to make it a little more consistent and fair so districts can look at that as more of a stable funding stream.
Very good. Okay, with that, Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That just prompted me to want to point out that, you know, the assumption that more services are going to be required based upon people being on the lower end of the economic spectrum potentially misses the fact that folks who are students in particular who are excelling also need additional services. And I think that's one of the problems that districts like mine and Representative Qualms and I'm sure some others in the room have, where there's lower per pupil funding on the bottom line as a result of all these different categories. One of the things that they run into, and I hear time and time again, and any of you have come out to our STMA legislative forums have heard this, that the students who are most affected by that lower per pupil funding are actually the ones who are missing out on opportunities to meet their full potential and truly excel because they don't have the funding available to do more AP classes or provide better educational opportunities to meet their full potential as opposed to just going along and getting along. So I just wanted to make that point. Thank you.
Point well made, Representative Hudson, and I think, and I'll just amplify that as well, because you're absolutely right. We can't solve the district problems here that your district is facing as easily. And when we put kids in a box where we assume we know their potential levels and then we try to tie it to a spreadsheet, we're going to get that wrong 96.7% of the time. So you're absolutely right, and just thank you for lifting that up. That was right on. Back to you, Chair Youakim.
Chair Krisha, thank you, and I want to thank you for that, too, and that's why having that proxy discussion is so important, and that's why Representative Feist's bill has a task force to get the right people at the table to talk about it, because we don't know if it's even the right proxy, and the OLA report said we don't even know how to calculate it. So it's been something that's needed to be looked at for a long time.
Follow-up, Representative Hudson, are you good? Thank you. Okay, members, let's go to the formulas and how they're linked to the general education. And then, Mr. Strom, if you could also talk about how that formula is linked to compensatory and those changes we're going to see there.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm a little worried about what happens at the end of Act 3.
The hero always wins, so you're good. Put your cape on. We're going to follow you out of here. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, in another one of your sleeves, there's... a single sheet listed at the top as formulas linked to the general education basic formula allowance. And a large part of this discussion today was about compensatory revenue and how and the general education formula and how inflation is playing into that. And what this worksheet intends to do is estimate the effect of what would happen if the formula allowance went up 1% and that current formula allowance is $7,481, and it shows the things that are linked to it. So as you travel down the page, you'll see the things that are linked to the general education formula allowance, and you'll see that we have currently about 926,000 pupils in the state. So on that first line on the basic formula allowance, a 1% increase times the 926,000 kids of the $74.81 would be the cost of what that would be. And thinking in the reverse direction, that additional 1% of inflation, if you went from 2 to 3% inflation, that would show the same amount. So it's not just about what an increase is, but it's sort of what every increase in the formula brings you. And you can see that the compensatory revenue goes up. It's the items here are linked, and those that are in the general ed modeling, compensatory by the formula allowance going up that $74.81 goes up $9.13 per pupil on average. Transportation sparsity is linked and goes up about a dollar on average for each 1% the formula allowance goes up. And then operating sparsity is quite a bit less at 35 cents. It's a smaller amount, it's linked. And then declining pupil unit aid is also linked. So for general education on the things that show up on our printouts, for every $74 you increase the formula allowance, you're going to get a almost $11 increase in other linked items to general education. Then there's a few things that are what we call off model that don't show up on the printouts. The biggest of those is PSEO payments to higher ed institutions, which the post-secondary institutions. And you can see that that's about 50 cents for every $74 increase. And then very small amounts because of shared time, the private alternative aid, and the supplemental online learning for a total of about 66 cents for those off-model programs. And then there are four formulas outside of general education that are also linked to the basic formula allowance. And ECFE for every $74 for the 1% increase in the general ed formula goes up about 50 cents per pupil. Non-public pupil transportation about 29 cents. Non-public pupil aid about 10 cents. And the relatively small amount for tribal contract schools. So putting that all together then, a 1% increase in the formula allowance, the basic formula goes up by $74.81 at the current rate. The linked programs would go up another $12.49, or an alternative way to say that is about for every dollar you put on the formula, or every 1% you put on the formula, you've got to pay about 17% more for the linked items that are going up as well. So the idea behind this single sheet is just to let you know that these things, and I think legislators are amongst you, are in favor and opposed to linking items, but this shows that those automatic increases happen with inflation, or if there's a 1% increase that folks want to do into the basic formula allowance, this is what it costs in those other areas as well. then the printout in your packet tries to show this amount, but focusing on the compensatory, and you can see the variations by district on this. So the first several columns show the what would the general ed revenue have been without inflation for this year. It would have been $7,281 on the basic formula. The 2.7% inflation factor brings that up by $200 to $7,481. That amounts the same for all districts in the state at that $200 per pupil. But then if you look at that biggest linked item, compensatory revenue, you can see here if there wasn't inflation built into the basic formula allowance, you can see what the increase there would be. What it is under the baseline assumption. And if you just, not to pick on Minneapolis, but if you just take Minneapolis because they're at the top there on line 1.3, you can see the statewide impact on compensatory is $27 per pupil on average. And Minneapolis, Aiken above, just above them, and I'm sorry for the spacing, I got the spacing in the wrong place here, Aiken, went up just about the state average at $28. The next couple of districts, Minneapolis and Hill City, are going up by $54 and $53 respectively. And then you can see some of the districts are going up at a much lower level than that. So you can see on the inflation on the formulas, even across, inflation on compensatory varies by the district's compensatory component. And you can see some districts are big winners under that and others relatively small winners on the compensatory, getting less than that state average. And then the last six columns or eight columns show these amounts on a total basis for total general education. So with inflation built in, the average district in the fifth to last column there, the average district's getting a $232 increase over where they'd be with no inflation, $232 per pupil unit. And you can see how that varies by district because of the things that are linked to the basic formula allowance. So, Mr. Chair, that's a quick summary of the impact that having the basic formula linked to inflation has on the other school funding formulas that we've got in the general education area and outside of general education.
Thank you, Mr. Strom, and thank you, Ms. Beckel and Ms. Parra. As always, fantastic. Members, questions? Or do you need to go cool your brains? I'm sorry, I've got Representative Vernix on the list, and then Chair Joachim, I'll start with you, and then I'll go to Representative Vernix. I'm sorry, you were on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to confirm, too, that the general ed programs that are linked to inflation, just I always keep asking Mr. Strom this because I keep forgetting it, is the basic formula allowance, the compensatory revenue, transportation sparsity revenue, which is what we discussed with Representative Anderson and Representative Hill's bills, operating sparsity revenue, and declining pupil aid. I know the declining pupil aid formula, I'm familiar with it, but can you just tell me what the operating sparsity revenue is?
Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, Representative Joachim, operating sparsity revenue goes to about 100 school districts in the state that are geographically isolated and serve a relatively few number of students. It's calculated at both the elementary and the secondary level, but essentially what it's trying to do is pay, unlike transportation sparsity, which is trying to pay for those transportation costs, operating sparsity is essentially saying the district might be smaller than can reasonably operate a one or a two section school, and so the additional operating money is intended to help the school district essentially meet its general operating purposes. There's a I believe there's a district by district printout in the last green sleeve that you haven't opened yet that's on the legal size paper. And if you look at that printout in the column labeled operating sparsity revenue, you'll see that statewide average is $35 per pupil. But as I said, only about 100 districts, and these are very small districts that qualify for it. And you'll see that real small school districts like number 2 Hill City and number 4 McGregor get very substantial amounts per pupil It doesn't amount to much on a statewide basis because they have such few pupils, but the idea behind it is that if a school district is geographically isolated, that it simply doesn't have a choice related to consolidation, and as a result, it needs additional operating money in order to offer the programming that is necessary. So you can look up and down that operating sparsity column. You can see some of the very small rural districts get very large amounts, but again, that's on a per pupil basis, and with a relatively small number of pupils, if you multiply the $1,455 that Hill City is getting by the 261 pupils, that's not a huge amount of money even for that district. But the idea of operating sparsity is geographic isolation is not something the district caused, but is just a fact that needs to be dealt with. So that's why that's a component of general education aid.
Thank you, Mr. Strom.
And thank you, Representative Vernick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question. I know a lot of schools tap into third-party billing for Medicaid. Do you happen to track at all how much they generate in third-party billing?
Mr. Chair, members, in the special education program, school districts are authorized by statute and by federal law to bill for certain kinds of health-related services that students face. Minnesota, for a variety of reasons, has used third-party billing, which is the name given to this billing, less than many other states. I think the current number is somewhere around $60 or $65 million per year that Minnesota school districts are receiving for third-party billing. Essentially, what happens is if that health-related service can be billed separately, the districts receiving the reimbursement from the payer, often the medical assistance program in each state, and then that amount doesn't need to go into the special education formulas and be partially reimbursed through special education. There are a variety of restrictions on the types of services that qualify for third-party billing, but Minnesota in total is a relatively small user compared to some other states of that program. And I'll see if I can find detailed information, but I think the last number I saw was in the $60 millions for the amount Minnesota has annually in third-party billing.
Thank you. I just want to say
Representative Vernon, go
yes,
ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you so much for going through this. I mean, it's really helpful to understand, and I think there's one thing you know, we could all agree on is we could use more money to help our educational system, maybe. One of the issues that I struggle with is it seems like we're fighting for crumbs, whether it's for special ed or, as Representative Hudson pointed out, gifted and talented programming in schools. And I know that we talk about flexibility a lot, but it sure would be nice to have a meeting where we look at the system itself in a more comprehensive way as opposed to aid and levy and requiring local voters to approve and really looking at, operating sparsity and compensatory aid revenue and all of the different little pieces and how they work together. Even just thinking from the long-term facilities maintenance perspective, you know, you submit a 10-year report, but they really only look at the next 2 years. And it would be nice at some point to look at it more comprehensively. I think in human services, somebody said, we don't have a behavioral health and mental health system. We have a patchwork of things, and it feels that way here with regards to education. So thank you.
And thank you, Representative Vernigan. You know, just my take on that as you open that conversation up. And I think it is complicated, of course, and we do end up with all the pieces here. But as legislators, we end up getting doctor's degrees and everything. And I, you know, to your point, we seem like we're fighting over crumbs, but we're also up against nursing home children with disabilities and families that are, you know, so it's a resource fight. It's an art of the possible. And we try to do what we can, but also remember as we go to other committees, we're also fighting these same battles for different reasons. So thank you for that. Before I go to Representative Lee and then to the close, members, we are going to, Mr. Withers will send out the OLA report link so that you should have that in your boxes. So Representative Lee and then afternoon, Kappa nap,
okay.
Cappuccino and a nap, right?
Yeah, I definitely need another cup of coffee right now. But yeah, thank you, Chair. I guess this question is for Mr. Strom, and I want to thank Rep. Bergnick for bringing this up, because I actually met with my assistant superintendent last week about our special aid funding. And one thing that, you know, she raised with me is that our school district gets $5 million for Medicaid for their special ed students. And so I know we had a conversation earlier about maybe new federal funds coming to the state for students. And I think for us, this discussion today was focused on state funding and like what we can do. But, you know, I think the other reality is we do rely on our co-governing partners, like the federal government. So, you know, we've also seen that there's a budget that's been passed in Congress that would slash Medicaid funding dramatically. And my question, I guess, to Mr. Strom, because of his institutional knowledge and just walking us through this discussion, is, you know, what happens if our school district doesn't get this Medicaid funding and we have students who have high needs that we are, you know, required to meet their needs for? What does that mean to our state budget and like our conversations going forward as we try to pass a budget that, you know, meets the needs of all of our students?
Mr. Strom, how's your crystal ball?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lee, very cloudy. I think the short answer in all seriousness is that because Minnesota is relatively less reliant on third-party billing than other states, the impact is likely to be much less if there are significant changes that change eligibility for medical assistance. Under the structure of Minnesota's special education funding, if let's say all third-party billing went away, those amounts would automatically be eligible for special education funding under the state system, which with the current design, roughly 60% is covered on the front end of the formula and another 20% through the cross-subsidy aid. So about 80% of the service should still be covered automatically through the special education formula. So what that would mean at the state level would be that if, you know, absent any other changes at all, if the change were simply all medical assistance that goes to third-party billing were eliminated, that 80% of that cost would automatically be picked up in the base of special education funding. This committee wouldn't need to take any direct action to do that, because that formula essentially is self-adjusting in the base. So that'd be the short answer. The much longer answer, you know, really is going to depend, I think, on what direction things happen. But right now, that's the short answer to what would happen to our special ed funding system.
Representative Lee, quick follow-up or?
Nope, all good. Thanks.
Thank you. So with that, members, this concludes our meeting for and our agenda for today. Our next meeting will be Thursday, March 13th, 2025. And thank you for everyone in your discussion. Thanks for all the great information. Committee stands adjourned.